Welcome back to Word Up with Dani Katz. I am your host, Dani Katz. I am an author, journalist, and a quantum languaging coach and consultant. What that means is that I teach people how language programs consciousness, how language programs reality at large, and how to transform reality and evolve our consciousness with language. I've also been known to cultivate and share an opinion or two or 12 about culture and consciousness and how they are evolving, devolving, and being manipulated by the powers that were. Here at Word Up, we are devoted to fostering critical thinking while supporting you in becoming your most authentic, empowered, liberated, realized, amazing version of yourself. Our every show aims to expand your consciousness, raise your frequency, sharpen your critical thinking skills, and make you giggle. And think. Given the radical uptick in censorship over the past few years, combined with the complete co-opting slash decimation of my own personal industry, journalism, I started Word Up to have a free speech-friendly platform in which to engage exploratory, solutions-based conversations with visionaries, mystics, original thinkers, and rebel badasses who are helping to make the world more wonderful. The first half of my interviews run between 30 to 90 minutes and are always posted here for free public listening. The second halves are reserved for paid supporters on my Patreon and my Locals platforms, where for as little as $5 a month, you can access all of my second half conversations along with oodles of other bonus content and opportunities to drop in with me, to drop in with our High Vibe tribe, and lots of other awesome things. In addition to interviews, Word Up also features quantum languaging upgrades, planetary service announcements, and propaganda analysis, which I call Spot the Propaganda. Thank you so much for tuning in and for sharing your sacred attention with me and our High Vibe tribe of change makers. Be sure to click that subscribe button so you can stay abreast of our every episode. Thank you for also clicking the like button, for sharing far and wide, and for leaving some kind words as a review as you are authentically inspired. As well, if you are gleaning any value whatsoever from these shows, consider supporting me on Locals and or Patreon. And as you are wanting to learn more about my quantum languaging coaching and consulting services or nab copies of my books, find me on DaniKatz.com as well as on quantumlanguaging.com. Okay, I think that's it for our housekeeping. Buckle up and prepare to enjoy this episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Greetings, superstars. Welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Today, I am joined by the one, the only Brandon Joe Williams. It's very hard to put Brandon Joe Williams in a box. He's basically walking the path of someone who knows the law better than most lawyers, most judges, most elected officials on the planet. And he's teaching people like you and me how to use the law, the real law, to our benefit. He's an educator, he has courses, he has a law firm. He is definitely worth checking out. Today's conversation is a phenomenal introduction into the wily world of Brandon Joe Williams, and I trust that you're gonna dig it. I recommend having a pen and paper handy because he drops some mad knowledge and some specifics and some details that will really serve all of us. So buckle up and prepare to enjoy my conversation with Brandon Joe Williams. How did you get into law?
I got into law because I was being attacked by the Employment Development Department, and they trespassed onto one of the jobs that my crew was working at, and they decided to cook up some weird bill that has nothing to do with anything. And that's kind of what started all of this craziness.
And at that point, were you still like, did you have faith in the system? Did you think it was all up and up? Or had you already started to rebel before this happened?
Well, I mean, a lot of people, when they first see my work, they think that I'm rebelling now, but actually, in fact, my life is more legal than it's ever been, and honestly, it's more legal and lawful than almost anyone in the planet. I operate entirely and fully within the confines of the system. In fact, 99.99999999% of people don't, actually. That's the issue. But with that said, no, I was living life the same as everybody else, and I had the same life as anybody else would have had. It was very, very normal. I thought I had a tax liability, and I thought I was a taxpayer, and I thought I lived in this thing called State of California, or this other thing called United States, and just lived my life at normal. And I had a driver's license because I thought I was a driver, and I had a bank accounts that had my name on it, and I had, corporations that I thought were mine, and I had the whole thing, all the same stuff, just like anybody else.
And so when you dove in to figure out what was going on with this bill with which you'd been presented, did that process shatter your worldview? Like, was it, what did you discover in that, and how did that shift you?
I mean, obviously it's very shifting. Pretty much everything you thought was true or real your whole life is pretty much shattered throughout this process. I would go so far as to say that the experience that Neo had when he was coming out of that pod and he woke up in the Nebuchadnezzar is probably pretty accurate. I'd say the only part of the matrix that isn't accurate is this idea that, once you come out of it and you wake up in the Nebuchadnezzar, you're eating this mush and you just kind of wish you could go back and eat some good food and stuff like that. I would go so far as to say the food on the Nebuchadnezzar is actually a lot better than it is in the system. So besides that, that's probably the only difference, I'd say.
And if I'm correct on this, you were in landscaping when this happened. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I had a landscaping company. I still do. We'll have to trust now, but it was a company at that time. And yeah, I took it over. It was a free company that I got because it was basically just abandoned and going to hell. And so it had a truck and it had a crew and it had tools and it had all the good stuff. So I was like, all right, I'll take a shot at this. And so I picked up the company, and that's, after several months, the EDD got involved, and that's when I got into all this stuff. And then I restructured the company as a trust and did a bunch of other things. And then at that point, the EDD no longer had any relevance to anything we were doing. In fact, if they would have continued to pursue us, they stopped pursuing us. If they would have continued to pursue us, I would have pursued criminal and civil charges, and I would have started putting people in jail, and it would have been very ugly for them. So they did a very smart thing by just simply going away. But yeah, it was a long process that got me to that point. Yeah.
And I know there's different languaging around this. So do you call the path that you walk, the information you share, common law? Like what's the correct lingo for what you're doing and what you're sharing?
Well, it's all the above. It's common law, it's statutory law, it's the difference between the two, it's the relationship that you have with the statutory system, it's the relationship that you have with common law, it's the relationship that you have with, the governments of the world, and then eventually it gets to a point where it's your relationship with all people and groups. Because you start getting into international diplomatic relations, which is what, the three main areas that I really get into. We have financials and negotiable instruments, and then we have nationality, citizenship, and then that gets into diplomatic relations, and then that gets into international diplomatic relations very rapidly. And then we have, so we have our own situation, and then we have our own nationality, and then we have our own citizenship, and then we have our own international diplomatic relations. So, for example, I have my own nation called the Nation of the Amnesty Coalition. I am just now putting together the website and putting together the like we're preparing for setting up a lot more media coverage and diplomatic coverage, and we're probably going to be working with the Department of the Interior, the United States government. And we're already working with the Department of State and the Internal Revenue Service. I'm getting EIN numbers issued for trusts that are legally located in the nation of the Amnesty Coalition. We just started getting those approved recently via the IRS. So we have a lot of really exciting things happening in terms of having our nation and then setting it up properly. And then once we have our own nation and once it is set up properly, then at that point, we're going to be reaching out and creating relationships. And then as we create more and more relationships, we're probably going to become possibly, maybe, join the United Nations. So it just all depends on how things kind of go down. Yeah. So it's very exciting. Very, very
And
exciting.
what would be the intention of joining the United Nations?
I don't know yet. I did read the contract or the covenant or however you want to describe it that they have for the United Nations. So it would be one of those things where, when we get to that point, it would be me flying out there, New York City, where I actually lived for 5 years. Love New York City. Miss New York City very much. Would love to visit. And I would meet with the UN, and we would kind of figure out what would that look like, and what would I bring to the table, and what would they bring to the table, and we would figure all that out at that point and see if a relationship was worth getting involved in, or maybe it's not. I don't know. So.
So you have these established government or government adjacent agencies who are helping you to create this nation. Is that accurate?
No.
Okay.
If you look at 18 USC 11, foreign government defined, it says that a foreign government is defined as, any faction or body of insurgents within a country with which the United States is at peace, irrespective of recognition by the United States. So it's like the way that it operates is basically it's kind of the same thing as like social or professional connections. Let's say, you have a business and someone wants to learn from you or sell you something and they just keep calling you incessantly. There's no base for that conversation to take place, right? Whereas let's say, I do something for you for free and I kind of prove my performance, or I already have sort of like a celebrity status and I've already proven my performance in a certain area. And then I reach out to you and you already know who I am. There's a lot more of like a basis there for some sort of communication to take place, right? It's the same idea in international diplomatic relations. So at this point in time, the Nation of the Amnesty Coalition doesn't really exist on anyone's radar. It doesn't need to be recognized at all in order to be legally classified as a foreign government. But the thing is that, the whole point of the definition of a nation, or the definition of the word peace, means that there is active relationships being built and there are active relations being put together. So in the future, once the nation is a bit more established, which is going to happen very soon, I'm going to start making my own passports. We already have our own license plates, so that's that we've had those for a few months. But passports is going to be a lot of work. So I'm putting together a coat of arms right now. We actually have a 99 Designs contest going right now to build that coat of arms out. And then once the coat of arms is done, then that's pretty much the last piece of the puzzle before we can start making passports. So I already have a connection into someone that is going to help me put together passports. So that's going to be exciting. So then once we have passports and that kind of thing, then at that point we would begin creating relations with more relations, because we already have relationships with the Department of State and the Internal Revenue Service. So at that point, it would be to create additional relationships with, I would say specifically the Department of the Interior is probably going to be the next step.
And when you say relationships, like, is this part of the to establish yourself as a peaceful nation? Is this why you're engaging with these entities? Are
Yeah.
you okay?
So it's to get that piece done. Do you have these plates on your car now?
Yeah, I've had them on there for I want to say 5 or 6 months, maybe. I'm not sure. Maybe 4, 5, 6 months.
Does LAPD have an opinion on this?
If they did, it wouldn't matter. I don't know. I don't think so. They're on my bike too. They look different because on a bike that's a much smaller plate, so that's structured a little differently. But it's the same color scheme, pretty much the same information. It's just in a different position on my bike. So I have one on my bike and I have one on my car. And yeah.
And why the IRS specifically? I thought the IRS was a private entity that really didn't have anything to do with the government.
Well, it's just one of those things where we need EIN numbers for trusts in order to open bank accounts. So, without that, we can't open bank accounts, within the confines of the United States of America. So we have all of our foreign trusts, which are all physically located and naturalized into the Amnesty Coalition or the nation of the Amnesty Coalition. But, in order to get bank accounts, we need an EIN number.
It sounds to me like you love the law and like this is a passion of yours. And I know for some of us, like I dabbled in sovereignty like way back in like 2007, and I went to the Manson Ranch and like took a course and was pitched some like $30,000 course. And anytime I personally have dipped a toe in and I go to like learn what I need to learn, my brain taps out because I'm like, this is boring. I hate this. I'm so not interested.
Yeah.
But it sounds like for you that you found like that you have a genuine love of law and all these like processes and statutes that it seems like one has to learn to walk the path that you're walking.
Yeah, and that's why I teach everything for free. I mean, I have a free course. I'm on shows like this probably 5 or 6 times a week. I do an email blast with all the new shows and all the new information once a week. And we've got I was looking at the stats this morning. I mean, we've got 2 or 3 million views in the past year. We've got well over 300,000 watch hours. If you combine all social media and YouTube and everything else, and it's growing at an exponential rate. So, we're going to be looking at 200 or 300,000 watch hours every 6 months, probably here pretty soon at the way things are going. So yeah, the graphs, all the graphs are straight up and vertical. I joke, I say they look like stripper poles sometimes. But yeah, it's amazing. And I go on these shows and I explain things, and I have like a major presentation that I do on nationality, citizenship, and taxation, which takes about 45 minutes to an hour to deliver the whole presentation. And I've given it so many times, and it's gone through so many different adjustments. That I could do it in my sleep with no notes, and I know everything and every definition and every single location and every single statute by heart. And the craziness and the crazy marketing and the pickles and everything, it's all part of trying, like you said, it's trying to make this information as palatable and enjoyable as possible to learn. Yeah. And we do a very good job of that. We have a lot of people in their 20s and 30s that are involved. A lot of excitement. It's probably the first time, my original purpose was to make all this information more palatable and more interesting to the younger demographics. And that was the whole reason why, I had one stupid fuck, and the whole reason why the pickles and all the stuff. It's all to invite the younger demographics into this information, of which, the younger demographics have never had any interest at all in any of this ever in the entire history of humanity. That my original purpose, I feel like I'm pretty damn good at it, honestly.
What makes you good at it?
Just it's just wild, and I'm singing and I'm cursing and I'm just crazy and making songs about definitions of words, and it's like a Beavis and Butthead, Sesame Street adult version combination, Adult Swim kind of a thing. It's a whole kind of crazy thing, the whole website and all the information and the emails. And I start off each email with some sort of like really horrible personal attack. So like today's, I just sent like an hour ago, it was "Hey there, you chunky bitch," was the beginning of the email. And then the emails always end with, and as always, go fuck yourself. And it's, and then the website and the pop-ups and the just everything, you know, the social medias. We have our own private Facebook group or private, and just everything. It's just the whole thing is just wild and crazy and fun. And we have thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. It could be tens of thousands at this point. I don't really have like a register, so I don't really know, of ambassadors that are ambassadors of the Amnesty Coalition, nationals of the Amnesty Coalition. So it's a very it's getting very big. You know, I'm well on my way to shows like Aubrey Marcus and Joe Rogan. So I think those shows will happen in the next several months for sure.
And so why, like, what is the appeal? Like, what is your pitch for why someone would be wise to start taking your courses, learning these things? Like, what's the big why in terms of us stepping into your world?
Well, I don't offer a world. I offer just information that's free that allows you to step outside of a world that you think is real that's not. For example, you think that the green things called Federal Reserve notes in your pocket are money. They are not. You think that you own your car because you are listed as the, or you think you are listed as the registered owner on the certificate of title. You actually don't really own that car in the way that you think you do, which is why you have to do smog and all the bullshit. You think that you're in this nation called the United States, and you're most definitely not. And you think that you live in something called State of New Mexico or State of California, which you absolutely don't. So, and you think that you are a citizen, which you most definitely are not. So it's a sad state of affairs. It's a state of affairs where people believe all these things and they think all these things and they think they have a tax liability. And none of these things are true at all.
So let's stick with the registration. I'm assuming your car is not registered.
No, because it's not owned by the state. It's owned by me. I have full what's called dominion over my car. So in
So
terms of the legal aspect, the state doesn't have any say or any ownership or any security interest in my vehicle. So the way it works is your vehicle is basically an asset, and when you get a certificate of title. If you look up the definition of the term registered owner, which is what your name is listed as on the certificate of title, registered owner is basically someone who has a security interest in an asset. So registered owner does not mean what you think it means at all. It means that you basically have beneficial usage rights of the vehicle, and the vehicle is actually owned by a different entity. That entity happens to be a business, and that business is called State of New Mexico. And that business is physically located in the District of Columbia. So you're basically donating your vehicle to a foreign corporate zone called the District of Columbia. And you're basically saying, I have the right to. It's really convoluted, actually. The way it really, really breaks down is you're wanting to operate your vehicle commercially within the District of Columbia. When you send your information into the State of New Mexico Department of Motor Vehicles, what you're doing is you're entering a contractual agreement to operate your vehicle as a commercial motor vehicle inside of the District of Columbia. And then registration stickers are actually the Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Program of 34 USC 12611. And that 34 USC 12611 breaks down that whole program and how it works. But basically, what you're doing is you're supposed to tell the Department of Motor Vehicles at what times of the day that your commercial motor vehicle is going to be operated and who's going to be operating it. And then what happens is you waive all of your rights. And you basically enter into a program where you are paying the state in order to have the police pull over your vehicle in order to verify that the vehicle is not stolen. And part of the Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Program is that you waive all of your rights and you waive the right to having what's called reasonable articulable suspicion, which is what the police need to have in order to pull you over. Now, even to this day, police believe that they need what's called RAS in order to pull you over. But if you look and read the Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Program, if you have active and current registration tags, the police absolutely do not need RAS to pull you over. They can pull you over just because they don't like the color of your car, and they can take the goddamn thing and they can put you on the side of the road, and there ain't a fucking thing you can do about it because you don't own the car. And the police are basically operating as a private security force on behalf of a business called State of New Mexico.
So what happens when one gets pulled over and you're dealing with like a 25-year-old green cop who likely knows none of this, but wants to cite you for not having that little sticker on your Amnesty National plates?
They can they a citation so what a citation is, so if you look up the definition of the word naturalization, it comes from 8 USC 1101 subsection A23, and the definition is naturalization is the conferring of nationality of a state upon a person after birth by any means whatsoever. So what happens is that when you sign any documentation such as voter registration, such as for a driver's license, and you state, under penalty of perjury, mind you, that you are a resident of State of New Mexico, you are actually naturalizing into this business called State of New Mexico, which is located in the District of Columbia. Now, inside of this nation called State of New Mexico, well, I don't know what yours would be called, but in California, it's called the California Vehicle Code. So if I naturalized into State of California, which is a business located in the District of Columbia, I would be contractually tied into what's called the California Vehicle Code, otherwise known as the CVC. What a citation is it's a micro lawsuit for breach of contract. And it's breach of contract in relationship to the CVC. If you are not naturalized into State of California, then you wouldn't have a contractual obligation under the CVC. So if they would like to write me a citation for breach of contract under the CVC, then that'd be very, very easy to manage and handle. What I'd probably do is I'd probably do a counterclaim, and I'd probably actually sue the officer, and I would sue the police station for wasting my time.
So how much, as you're walking this path, how much time do you spend in a sort of combat reacting to things like this, suing people, engaging this the justice system, as far as remedies go?
No one ever sues me. I'd love to see it. I would turn it into a circus spectacle super rapidly because all my everything I have is all in private trusts, and the way that I'm set myself up, and I have trademarks, and I have name change, court ordered name changes, and I have so many. I mean, you couldn't touch me with all the money and all the lawyers in the world. It'd be hilarious to see anyone even try. But I have four current cases that I am the plaintiff on, going after American Express, going after AG Farm Financial Services, going after Compass Realty, going after there's another one, I forget the name of it, Wings Financial, which is a mortgage company. I'm working on a very, very large lawsuit going after the Department of Motor Vehicles in California, Indiana, as well as South Dakota. So, and I have many, many other lawsuits, and I have a law firm, and I have clients. I have one client onboarding, which will have several mortgages. We're going to be going after several different mortgage companies, and then we're also going to be going after the county, which is also a private business located in the District of Columbia. County of Los Angeles is a business listed on Dun and Bradstreet, and that business is located in the District of Columbia. So your counties that you think you own your home, you don't own your home, which is why you pay real estate taxes. And it's also why you need to get permits. Because the thing is, the county owns your home and you are just the registered owner. It's the same system as with cars.
Okay, so it sounds like.
So I don't have any defensive anything. I would laugh hysterically. I'd probably laugh for two solid days if someone tried to come after me. But as the plaintiff going after others, it's very enjoyable.
Got it. So for those of us, like, is there a way to walk this path, whether we're changing our status, discharging our debt, setting up trusts, whatever it is there a way to walk this path, not be in combat, not sue people, not be awash in paperwork and all of these legal details?
I guess, but the thing is, I think as you learn more and more and more about this, I mean, my current lawsuits, you know, it's well over $400 million in lawsuits. And when I file the DMV one, it's probably going to be $500 million. So, you know, we're going to be pushing $1 billion here by the end of the year and maybe even more. And the way lawsuits work is that, you know, you have these things called causes of action, right? So a cause of action is basically the reason why you're filing, right? Whether it be breach of contract could be a cause of action, or breach of fiduciary duties could be a cause of action, or you could take a specific statute, such as like, you know, fucking with my rights, which would be a certain couple areas in law where they have listings on that. There's even one, 15 USC 1, where any restraint on any commercial flow is up to $100 million in damages if the person that you're suing is a corporation. So there's a lot of different ways that, you know, I don't know. I look at it as, you know, do you want to make hundreds of millions of dollars a year? You can build a huge company and you can do all that and it can take forever and this and that. Or you just get involved in litigation and you can make $100 million a year your first year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to you. I mean, I don't see why someone wouldn't want to do this, but I understand that it's definitely more of a masculine thing than it is a feminine thing. To answer your question, of course, definitely. And the thing is that if you didn't want to do any of that and you just wanted to be left alone and this and that, you can. But the thing is that if anyone ever sues you, a lot of what people do and a lot of what people teach is how to get that case dismissed. I don't teach that at all. I think that's the biggest mistake that's ever been taught in my whole area. What you want to do is if anyone sues you, you want to turn around and you want to countersue them and you want to sink your teeth and your nails as deeply into them as you possibly can in a way where they couldn't dismiss it with all the money and all the hope in the world. Absolute, I call it violent, but I don't want it to get mixed up with actual violence, but it's a violent counterattack. Always. I feel like that's the only way you're ever going to truly be free, because then who's going to want to sue you? Like, for example, you sue me, I'm going to turn around and counter sue you so fucking hard. I'm going to have like 15, 18 causes of action on a counter sue, on a counterclaim, and you'll be begging to get out of it. And you won't have a hope in hell of ever getting out of it. And I'll drag in additional parties and additional defendants, and I'll write up, you know, I'll get the case into discovery, and I'll be writing subpoenas, and you'll be working for me for the rest of your life.
Now, have you gone to court with these, you know, any of these?
All four of my cases are listed on my website, williamsandwilliamslawfirm.com. The cause number and the courts and the initial paperwork with the civil cover letter, the summons, and the complaints are all available for download. And then people don't realize this, but there's a system called PACER, P-A-C-E-R. You can create a PACER account for free. And then the way it works is you can actually type in what kind of court you want to go to, and you can type in the cause number of, and you can actually pull up the whole docket. And you can download every single filing into the docket. The only kind of the cases you can't do this with is, let's say there's like a child and there's like medical information on a child, things like that, or like very sensitive information, such as if something is talking about someone's social security number or, but it's very rare that you see that kind of thing. 99% of everything done in litigation is all completely on a public forum, and anyone can download any of the docket items. So for example, on my YouTube channel, we just released litigation mini course video number one, and then litigation video course video number two is coming literally any day now. Could be today or tomorrow even. And on video number two, I actually walk you through how to navigate PACER, how to look up cases. We get into the Wesley Snipes case. We get into the actual docket, which we're going to be doing in video number three. We're going to be getting into the docket. It's 602 filings on the original case, so it's a lot. And myself and my right-hand man, Joey Kimbrough, we're going to be going through that docket live in a show. But on the second video, I go through my American Express case live. We go through a huge section of the docket. It's like a three and a half hour video. So the thing is that to answer your question, I have four different cases. I have not had to have any appearance into any courtroom, whether it be through a teleconference or otherwise at all in all four cases yet. So it's just paper. It's just a lot of paper that goes back and forth for it's been a month and a half, 2 months now for all the cases. So just a lot of paper that goes back and forth.
I guess what I'm wondering is when you're dealing with other lawyers or organizations or judges, I'm guessing that you know way more than they do. And I'm wondering how you're met and how you're received when you're stepping into these realms with all the knowledge that you have and this sort of like aggressive cutthroat style you have.
It's very enjoyable. I have not had the pleasure to deal with any judges yet because it's just been paper, 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 paper. In a lot of the cases, we've exhausted every single avenue of paper, so it has gone to the judge to make determinations. We just have our very first hearing for our first case scheduled for, I believe, the 28th, the 29th. That's going to be our first interaction actually with a judge or with a court above and beyond defense attorneys. And then to answer your question about defense attorneys, it's hilarious because all they do, they don't know anything about anything. They really don't. If you know, the biggest mistake you can make in your life is to think that attorneys know anything about anything. And I mean literally anything about literally anything. What attorneys do is they dress up in nice suits and they find documentation that someone else used. They don't understand any of it and they put your name on it and they submit it to the court and they tell you that they're working for you and they have no fucking clue what they're doing. And I'm talking, unless you're meeting like a trial attorney, which is somebody who's actually gone to trial and built out a case and you've seen evidence that they actually know what they're doing and they've done it, it's horrifying. And basically what happens is that at that point, the attorneys, what they do is they fall back on their favorite tool and their only tool, which is intimidation and threats. And that's all they do. They just intimidate, they threaten, they say that this is unauthorized practice of law. They say, we're going to sanction you. They say this is a frivolous lawsuit. They file for what's called sanctions. They file for, they say that that's a harassment, that lawsuit has no basis and it's harassing their client. That's literally all they do. And all you do to win the case is you just say, that's great, but that's all irrelevant. Let's get back to the actual complaint. Let's get back to the actual items that are in the complaint, the actual legal items that we need to speak of. And then they freak out like children and they cry and they hit the ground and they whine and they cry and they throw a temper tantrum. And then you just grab them and you say, that's great, but that's irrelevant. We're going to go back to the complaint. And you bring it back to the complaint, and you literally just keep doing that over and over and over and over. And they just keep throwing temper tantrums over and over and over. It's all irrelevant. And they're just billing their client, putting all this horse shit into the court. And then when you exhaust all that, then they're fucked. As far as I'm concerned, that's basically the whole process. But I haven't gone through that whole process A to Z yet. So, we'll see, but that's basically what it appears that the process is so far and what it will be into the future. So
Okay.
once you get past all that, so once you file the complaint, they always, as far as we're concerned, we see it every single time, they throw a temper tantrum and they file a motion to dismiss and they just fill it with horse shit. So once you get past that, then what you can do is you force them, like for example, we have four cases. Some of the complaints were filed months ago, 2 months ago, and trying to get these attorneys to answer the complaint, which means to go down each line item and respond to each individual line item of the complaint, is almost impossible. I mean, they are just freaking out like a screaming child that's like shrieking in violence. It's a good indicator that we have great complaint because trying to get them to answer it is like they feel like they're dying, which they kind of are. So it's hilarious. But once they answer the complaint, then at that point you can motion the court into what's called discovery. Now, the way I have not had the pleasure of operating in Discovery yet. I've been studying a lot about it. I'm very excited about it. So what Discovery is that once you move the case into Discovery, it's like the court is issuing you a badge, a gun, and a shovel. You can write subpoenas, even on third parties. You can write interrogatories, so questions that have to be answered under penalty of perjury. So you can actually start putting people in jail if they lie and you can prove it. You can do what's called a deposition, which is where you actually fly out there, or if it's local, you would actually take someone from the corporation or the individual that you are suing, and you would place them in a room, and there's a certain lighting that would be set up, and then it'd be a video camera, and then they would have to swear under penalty of perjury under oath at the beginning of the video. And then, like, for example, in federal cases, I believe it's up to 8 hours. You can literally interrogate this person. And if they say absolutely anything at all that is knowingly false and you later prove it, they can face very, very serious financial penalties as well as jail time.
It sounds like you have balls of steel and like an insanely strong will. Have you always been like that, or is this something you've cultivated as you've gone deeper into this realm?
I don't know. To me, it's just, what's right, and I don't know. I guess it's sort of like, why are angels always depicted having swords? You know what I mean? I don't know. I'm not saying I'm an angel. I'm just saying, like, it's more of like a masculine energy. You destroy for the a good cause. It's that's the masculine. That's what we're supposed to do as men. We're supposed to, I mean, we do other things too, but it's a huge part of our structure, which I studied for a long time. What is a man? What is a woman? How does that work? And how are we built, and why, and the relationship between the two. And I do feel that as a man, one of my duties is to destroy in the name of peace. Which I know sounds kind of weird, but seriously, I think that's why angels are depicted with swords, because we are supposed to destroy in the name of peace, destroy in the name of tranquility, and destroy in order to build a better world. I don't know. That just seems normal to me.
May I ask in what context you studied the masculine feminine?
I mean, it was something that I've been trying to figure out for ever since I was about 18, 17 years old. I'm a member of what's called the Amorati, which is the inner cloister of a larger group called the Ars Amorata, and it's all based off of a book called The Alabaster Girl, written by Zanparian. But I've also been a part of the Fearless Man with Brian Bijin. I've also read a lot of books, Models by Mark Manson, I believe his name is, and many, many, many books about, all sorts of things involving masculinity and femininity. And, even Robert Greene books get into that a lot, like The 40 Laws of Power, or whatever the book is by Robert Greene. So there's a lot of things that I've read on this, and it's just been a long journey for me in terms of wanting to understand it, and trying to figure it out, because I just didn't get it, and I don't think very many people do. But it's one of those things you don't even know that you don't know until you start looking at it, and then you go, holy shit, I don't know anything about this. It's like a lot of the stuff I teach, it's amazing how much you don't know. It's just absolutely mind-blowing.
And what's your take on the larger masculine feminine situation on planet Earth right now, or at least in Los Angeles where you are?
I think that women still have a lot of their gender intact, I think, but men, I think, are losing it big time. And I think that's why women are starting to move more and more into masculine roles, because I think that they feel like they kind of have to. And I don't think that women really know how to help men get back on the rails, and I don't think men do either. So yeah, it's just kind of a mess. But I think a lot of it's on the male side, personally.
Do you think it's on women to help men get back on the rails?
I think it's an option. I don't think there's such a thing as, I think obligation is the only sin there is in the world. So I wouldn't consider it an obligation. But I think that women have the option, if they would so choose, to be a lantern that to assist us in refinding ourselves. Yes.
And how do you see us doing that? How would you like to see us doing that?
Questions, lots of people asking lots of questions, historical research, what is it? What is it about our past? What are we supposed to be doing in various cultures, and what did we do in various cultures, and what was our role in, let's say, Rome, or what was our role, let's say, in even in the, you go back to like the Knights Templar, or let's say you go back to homesteading, when people were traveling west in the United States of America. There's all these different time periods, and what was the gender roles between men and women, and why, and then understanding what we're supposed to be doing, and just having better discourse between us. And I think that women have excellent discourse between other women and themselves. We don't have that option, because if we get into that kind of a discourse with other men, it's considered gay and unacceptable. So, most men live their life in quiet desperation, because they never have the opportunity to evaluate any of these things, or evaluate their emotions, or anything like that. So they grow up and they become these sort of very emotionless, kind of logical thinking individuals that can't really even express or describe their own thinking and their own emotional state, because they were never given the opportunity to. And then you have women who are doing it their whole lives, and then they expect us to do it. We just can't do it. We're not anywhere near. I think one of the things I think women take for granted is that power that they do have to understand emotion and body language, and read people, and read a room, and feel out various subcommunications that they've been doing since they were born, and they just don't realize that it is a skill that they've had to work tremendously hard to attain, and they just don't see it that way, because it's just, as far as they're concerned, it's like breathing. And the thing is that we're on the opposite side of that scale, and it's taken me, 16 years to develop a lot of those skills. And I developed it through a lot of training, and a lot of mentoring, and through, honestly, a lot of sales experience. So, yeah, I just think that, if I think if women realized what they have, and then they realized how hard they actually had to work for it, it didn't seem hard. It's like saying breathing is hard. But the thing is that you did have to practice that, and you did have to work with that, and you did work with that for your whole life. And so, we as men need to want to develop some of those skills. And then we have a very long road, because we're usually below zero on those scales. We're not even allowed to talk about those things. So to even get up to a zero takes a lot of work. And then from there, once we're at zero, then we can build those skills. But it's a very long road, very, very long road for most people.
Yeah, I appreciate your perspectives. I mean, I'm of the mindset that it takes two to tango, and we live in a realm of equal and opposite forces. So if the masculine is out of balance, and so too is the feminine, because we're always dancing together. So I see, as far as me taking responsibility for the feminine, hyper masculinized, hardened, harsh, and I see that as a result of second wave feminism, which seemed like a giant psyop. But it's interesting that you mentioned the Templars, because if we, if we buy into the story, I know a lot of them were men of the cloth, so they weren't even engaged with women, but supposedly they had gone to Israel to protect everyone and to like safeguard the pilgrims. And one thing that I feel is devoid in our current culture is any notion of the men safeguarding not just women, but freedom, justice, I see that as a place where, like, I as a woman am longing for the men to step into that role of being noble, of being heroic, of standing up for what's right. And I'm not seeing that to the extent that I would like to be seeing that.
Yeah, I think in the West, I think litigation is a male rite of passage. Now that I'm in it, and now that I'm moving through it, I feel like every man, not as an obligation again, but I feel like if a man, if a boy would like to become a man, I feel like in the West, there's two options. There's one option is hardcore hand-to-hand combat in a competitive way. And I think option two is litigation. I feel like both of those things are rite of passages that turn boys into men.
And I just want to make sure that I'm not confused. Have you engaged in litigation? Is what you are doing on the day-to-day litigation? I'm not super clear on my legal terminology.
Yes. Yeah, I have four
Okay.
cases rolling right now, and I'm working on one more. And then I have another one I have to write, and then I'm currently working on onboarding somebody who will have probably seven or eight or nine of them. So we're going to have, by the end of the year, we'll have probably, 10, 15 rolling.
And I'm a journalist. That's my background. And so I'm really attuned to being targeted, things that could make it unsafe for me. And I know that the Biden administration has passed these new domestic terrorism laws that have me feeling like it wouldn't be wise to file a lot of the paperwork that I see people in your realm filing in terms of it raising red flags and getting me accused of being a domestic terrorist. Have you seen anything like that happening?
No, I mean, you have the option. It's very, very clear. Title 8, Section 1101, Subsection A 21, 22, and 23. You even looking on an I-9 form, the employment eligibility verification form, looking on gun purchase forms, looking on a DS-11 passport application form right above the signature section. People don't notice it. It's kind of all over the place, but you have a citizen of the United States, and then you have what's called a non-citizen national of the United States. And if you look at 22 CFR 51.2, it says that passports are only issued to U.S. nationals. People don't realize that. And actually, if you go into the passport office, they'll tell you that passports are issued only to U.S. citizens. That is absolutely flabbergastingly false information. Very, very clear. 22 CFR 51.2, passports are issued only to U.S. nationals. Definition of U.S. national is 8 U.S.C. 1101, subsection A22. The definition of a U.S. national is A citizen of the United States, or B, a person who, though not a citizen of the United States, owes permanent allegiance to the United States.
How was that determined?
By you.
If I just decide that I owe permanent allegiance, or I could say, nah, I don't.
Yeah, anyone who pledges allegiance to the United States is considered and they aren't a citizen. They are called a U.S. national, subsection B, or more clearly, a non-citizen national of the United States. You don't have to live in the United States to be a non-citizen national of the United States. And when you look up the definition of what United States means, it means a federal corporation located in the District of Columbia. So I don't live in the United States, but I have pledged allegiance to the United States, and that's how I got my passport.
Are there ways that you're messed with? Like, do you have a driver's license?
No, I don't qualify for a driver's license because a driver's license requires you to sign under penalty of perjury that you are a resident of State of California, which is a business located in the District of Columbia. I am not a resident of State of California. I'm not a resident of any of the 50 corporate versions of the states that are all located in the District of Columbia. So it would actually be perjury, and I could go to prison for up to 1 year if I try to get a driver's license.
So, does that back up on you in your meanderings through the world when you're asked for ID or when you're asked for your license?
No, I have my passport card. So if you look at the DS-11 passport application form, at the very top it says, do you want a book, a card, or both? And there's also, a lot of people don't see it too, there's also a regular size book, and there's also a large book, which is, I've never seen one in person, but it's a lot bigger. The actual physical book is quite a bit larger. It's a little bit of extra fee to get the card, but you can get yourself a passport card, and that is what I use for identification because I passports are issued only to U.S. nationals, and driver's licenses are essentially only issued to citizens. So, because I am not a citizen of the United States, I can't get a driver's license, but as a non-citizen national, I can get a passport.
Is this path advised for those who don't like conflict, who don't like paperwork, who don't get the same pleasure out of these steps that you seem to take?
I mean, it's up to you. It's sort of like that one guy, what's his name? Even in The Matrix, that one guy who was like, just plug me back in. I just want to eat a steak, you know, blah, 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 blah. But the thing is that, you know, being in the system is very painful in a lot of ways. So you have to, you have to make a decision. Is the pain of the paperwork greater than or less than the pain of having to get driver's licenses, having to file federal income tax, having to pay state tax, having to pay property taxes, having to get permits for your home, having to pay a mortgage, having to, you know, get a driver's license, having to be worried when police are near you or that you could get pulled over and you could get accosted by the police. You could get tickets, you could get citations, you could get, it's the same game. You know, when I get pulled over, the police don't know that there ain't a goddamn thing they can do. They learn very rapidly, but the thing is that they can do all the shit that you think they're gonna do to me. They can do all the same shit to you.
Can you walk me through Brandon Joe Williams getting pulled over and how that exchange goes? That does it for the first half of my conversation with Brandon Joe Williams. As you are inspired to tune into the second half, which I highly, highly recommend because he shares some really phenomenal tools and techniques, as well as going into an unexpected part of his story, you can find that second half on both my Patreon and my Locals communities. Those addresses are dannycats.locals.com and patreon.com/dannycats. I'm also reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannycats.com. It is the very best way to ensure that we stay in touch regardless of what sort of big tech nonsense is happening out there in the world. And as you are inspired to learn more about me, Danny Katz, my books, my webinars, my courses, how to work with me one-on-one in a coaching capacity, how to learn about my group coaching community, how to bring me into your organization as a languaging expert and consultant, you can learn all about me at dannycatz.com as well as quantumlanguaging.com. All right, that does it. I look forward to seeing you over on the Patreon and the Locals for the second half. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. Have a rockin' day.
And for clicking that subscribe button, for liking, for sharing, for commenting, and for leaving some kind words as a review, as you are authentically inspired. As you are receiving any value from my podcast, as you dig it, as you listen regularly, consider supporting me on Patreon and/or Locals, where for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half podcast interviews, as well as oodles of bonus content. Your support really goes a long way in supporting me as a journalist and an independent content creator navigate her way through a really crunchy time in terms of free speech. And as you are wanting to learn more about my work in the world, my books, my products, my quantum languaging coaching and consulting, you can find me at dannycats.com as well as quantumlanguaging.com. And if you're not down with a membership patronage platform and want to send me a one-time donation, you can use the Bitcoin link if it actually appears on your podcast listening platform. You could also send me a one-time donation by way of PayPal at dannycats@pm.me, or by way of Venmo, where my username is Sadie Bloom. Again, your support means the world and makes a massive, massive difference when it comes to continuing to share this work with the world. Thank you for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that you are omniscopic amazingness and for having a rockin' day. See you next time, superstars.